Did people have a chance to look at Trolloc Rinpoche's discussion? Any reactions to it? Did you like it? Was it opaque? Was it interesting? Was it
the reading
on the relative bodhicitta and its slogans? Anybody want to just sort of say what it was like for you?
I like the last thing he said, but I have to look at it again.
Okay, what was the last thing he said? Page 80 or something.
81.
Mm-hmm.
Just that whole last paragraph, just sort of pushing and not pushing.
Mm-hmm.
Sort of finding that balance of
an
aspiration without a... I always think that word exertion always I have to think about, because I think it's like many of those words where our idea of what exertion is like you're really sweating hard or something, like that's exertion, not like you're doing what you need to do.
Right. Uh-huh. He says, and there's all kinds of nuggets here, we can develop positive qualities before we overcome our negative ones. That's just lovely. So that what that does is reduces our preoccupation on our problems and our limitations and screw-ups. And say, okay, develop something different. They call that reinforcement of incompatible behavior. The psychology folks. It kind of works.
Thank you.
So... anyone else? I read this and I reread this and I had a great time and I took notes and then I took notes on my notes and then I tried to get things into these three illegible index cards and I had a great time with this stuff. And it's wonderful presenting Tonglen and relative bodhicitta, because you sort of have a chance to sort of see where you are. Sort of a little bit of self-appraisal. And I decided that I could use some improvement. And I could use a faster rate of improvement over the next future than in the past. Although, there are some things I felt very inspired by. And then I realized, when I've read similar material by, like, the Dalai Lama, Dogo Khyentse Rinpoche, they all say, you know, I haven't really got this stuff down yet, but I'm really inspired by it. And I find that very helpful.
Yeah.
Because there's a tendency to take this material and become theistic about it and feel that it's way out there and we're sort of like here. But that's not the point at all. It's actually contrary to the point. And what's lovely about this material is it breaks down very easily into a very simple logic. And in Tibetan Buddhism, they love doing classifications and logic. And there's ground, path, and fruition. It's like, where are you starting from? What do you want to do? What are you going to get from it? But there's another one that I'm going to use tonight called view, practice, and action. Because it starts with, like, what are we doing? Why are we doing it? What's the point? So if you're new, it's a good chance to sort of start from the beginning and say, well, what is the point here? Then the practice itself, we'll talk about sending and taking our Tonglen. And some people have a few decades of experience with this or experience struggling with this. And we'll share our strength, hope, and opinions about Tonglen. And then there are the other slogans, which is the action, which is how do you take what you've done on the cushion and bring it onto the world? And so, if it turns out that you're very benevolent on the cushion, and you're sort of a jerk at home, then there's a problem that you need to address. And it's not your benevolence.
That's good.
So, What's the view? Trialic Rinpoche really stresses that the foundation of these relative slogans is absolute. Mm-hmm. Absolute bodhicitta. He's very clear about that. More clear than a lot of other teachers are in their presentations of this. So, what do you mean by absolute bodhicitta? Actually, let me ask you. Anyone have a foray? No, I'm not going to pick on anybody. Except my fellow teachers.
Hold up your book.
There is no escape.
I just have to go to the bathroom.
Sorry. I used that in third grade in a math question.
Trialic Rinpoche talks about the natural state. What's the natural state? The natural state is something we can discover on the cushion. It's something that we bring along with us all the time. It's our own mind. But it's not the mind that that believes in the thoughts that it's thinking, which is most of the mind that we tend to use. It's that mind that is neutral, that is luminous, that can, because it has no fixed nature, it can accommodate everything. And it accommodates everything. It's multiple. So this is the mind that we have. It is, in some ways, an ordinary mind. It's a mind we don't have to develop. We have to clear away stuff so it's there, that we can apprehend it, but we really haven't parted from it. So that's the natural mind. We also know that because of that, we can lucidly dream our world. That we don't have, because mind can do anything, we realize the power of mind, it doesn't have to get so hung up. It can move around. It can direct itself. Some weeks ago, Michael talked about shamatha and sort of taming the mind and allowing it its virtues, its power to come out through sort of boycotting our usual distracted state. We also know that innate is our heart. That all of us want to be kinder. All of us want to be better. All of us have, when we're not freaked out about life and not inconvenienced by other people, we actually have a sympathetic... they've actually done studies. They've done studies on compassion. That if that we're extremely compassionate except when it's inconvenient. And now we could get cynical about that, or we can appreciate that, that we all have that ground base of compassion. We get in the way because we get freaked out. But we have inherently our own warmth, an open and loving attitude. It may not manifest all the time. I dare say it probably doesn't. But we know it's there. And even if you're the most hardened sociopath, it's going to be there. So that's part of the natural state. Please.
What's the difference then between potency and all these?
What do you mean by potency? Well, that's a good question, I think. I know what you mean.
When you say it can manifest, that it seems to still need training. The ordinary natural mind needs training. So
why does it need training? If it's ordinary and natural.
Yeah.
How? That's what I'm asking. Well, you're asking me.
Yeah,
well, I was going to ask
like
you.
I kind of instantly thought that the the possessive, the dualistic mind to be trained to unravel itself.
Mm-hmm.
And then when you get to sort of, let's say, the last onion skin, then the naturalness reveals itself, or it's accessible, or it's innate, but then it still needs to, it's not going to be developed, I guess, it's going to be innate availability or something.
You know? There's no answer to that. That is very much the point of the natural state. I want to leave your comment just in the open, because I think that's very much the point here. The fact is that we do not experience these conditions of mind. We also know how powerful mind is. Natural mind, but also dualistic mind. We know how completely deluded we can be and how powerful that delusion can be. And we say, what was I thinking? Okay. But what we're doing here is part of that, you could call it an unraveling process. You could call it a training process. You could call it a letting go of our crap process. So what is inherent can actually emerge, not from us, but just emerges. The Mahamudra teachings talk about sort of awareness becoming aware of itself. It's like, we don't become aware of it. The awareness itself becomes aware. It's an extraordinary notion. Anyone?
The evaluation.
Go for it.
But what that makes me think of it is a magnificent experiment, since you mentioned experimentation. I think recently, let's say within the past 10 years, they videotaped the growth of the development of a monkey or a chimpanzee.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And they interpreted that they videotaped the actual moment the animal looked in the mirror, who knows how many times, and
understood itself.
Magnificent.
That's right. I think I may have like scrolled and I saw that. Yeah. It's sort of like, in some way, that's an awareness becoming aware of itself. So, monkey. Now, we all know, I mean, the natural state is the good news, but we all know what we do with that, which is we tend to become obsessed with this, with ourselves. We tend to close ranks, circle the wagons, however you want to call it. We know what that kind of claustrophobic tendency we all have feels like. We get defensive, we get self-absorbed, we get self-conscious, we get awkward, we get anxious, we suffer. We don't just have pain, we have suffering, which is like, what does this pain have to do with me? And we create stories about ourselves. And we find that our attempts to make ourselves happier don't tend to work very well. We try this, we try that. We try a relationship, we try a better job, we try a better house, we try self-improvement. And it doesn't work. We feel like stuck. And a lot of that is because we have trained our mind so much on ourselves that we have become impoverished. We have reduced our abilities. At the same time, we have this natural mind, this inner warmth, like trying to come out, and we continually block it. Shanti Davis says that we all desire happiness, but if we seem to step on the causes of happiness, we're really good at the causes of misery. Even though we said we want happiness, it's pathetic. is especially pathetic because we know it doesn't have to be that way. Ever been through an experience where you're going through all kinds of stuff and you sort of come out on the other side and say, what the hell was that for? That was like unnecessary. Mm-hmm. Well, that's our confusion as sentient beings. It's unnecessary. It's added on. So the question is, what do we do with that? We can beat ourselves up, but we've tried that before. And chances are it hasn't worked for you, because it really doesn't work for me at all. So beating ourselves up and feeling terrible becomes only one more way to become absorbed in ourselves. But what if we use that basic warmth that we have, that soft-heartedness that we have, and try to use that to make connections, to sort of open ourselves up? Shantideva also says, I can't help quoting him, him and Dante, I'm sorry, just it's a compulsion. He also says that sentient beings, that's us, think about themselves. Buddhas think about other people. Look at the difference between them. So, how do we get there? Do we just sort of like do good stuff? We've tried that. We try that a lot. We wind up that we in codependent relationships. We wind up not being a help, but being a nuisance. Our attempts to be helpful, actually, we realize that they aren't really helpful. They just try to make us feel better. Or because we can't stand the pain of other people, because it makes us feel squirmy. So we try to, like, quell that. And so just helping others doesn't work. What does work, Prabhupada Rinpoche says, is we have to work on our own mind. We have to transform. We have to look, we have to open up our way of being. So we're starting from the premise, as Trungpa Rinpoche said, that, and I'm sure those of us who did sitting before, now, he said that of all of our thoughts, 90% are I and 10% are am. So there's no point to being idealistic. We have to get to work. in spite of the natural mind, in spite of our natural compassion, we find that we do that.
Yeah.
That's one of the treasures of meditation practice. It teaches us humility right off the bat, because we find that out really quickly. Just how everything is this sort of center of the universe thing. And I thought that was my problem. Then I realized everybody else thought they were also the center of the universe. And that was very helpful, actually. Okay. So, part of the view is that there's a way out. And we can talk about absolute bodhicitta, which is that sense of the natural state, which also is sort of our sense of the dreamlike fabric of our experience, that things are not as substantial as we think they are, that things are actually wide open. And there's relative, which is that desire we have, as futilely achieved as it is, to love and be loved. And I don't think Buddhists talk about love as much as they should. But that's relative bodhicitta. You want to help people because you have this capacity for love. So the reward is we reduce our anxiety, our small mind becomes a large mind, and we even have the opportunity to be genuinely helpful instead of just wanting to be. And that's the payoff. So that's the view. It's a good view. And obviously, Buddhism has lots of different possibilities, but the one we're talking about here is that of sending and taking. And you know, okay, what are we sending? First of all, I guess a number of people have done this previously. You've done some tonglen. Mm-hmm. You have. Okay. If you've been on formal retreats, you may have had that opportunity. And tonglen are simply the Tibetan words for sending and taking. They're ordinary words, ordinary vocabulary. So there are different instructions by different teachers. And I really like how Trailuk Rinpoche breaks it down, but we're going to add to that a little bit. He talks about beginning with the preliminaries, which he meant is refuge or bodhisattva vows. Now, some of you have taken some of these and some of you haven't. It's not mandatory if you haven't. It's helpful if you have, because we're on the cushion. And it's very useful to feel that we're doing something that people have been doing for centuries. That we're joining in. We have joined into this larger project, and all the teachers you admire, past, present, and future, are kind of there with you. That's the thing about taking refuge. You'll never be lonely again. Bodhisattva vows, for those of you who've taken bodhisattva vows, merely ups the ante. That you are committing yourself to opening up and being genuinely helpful to people until you have emptied samsara. That's all. So we've upped the ante a little bit. But, Janet.
You know, I was just thinking that one of the things they talk about in this chapter is about intention.
Yes.
You know, and
yes.
You know, my background is health education, but mm-hmm. they talk about one of the biggest predictors of like behavior change or attitude change is one's intention.
That's right.
You know, so if you go into this with the intention of, be it with the refuge vows or mm-hmm. the bodhicitta vows, mm-hmm. you're more likely to actually take them on.
And if you've contemplated through meditation our existence as sentient beings, and you develop sort of I like the word defiance sometimes. It's like, I'm not going to put up with all this confused bullshit from myself, and I'm going to help other people not be so damn confused. That's an intention. You know, it's like, I think of Scarlett O'Hara with her radishes saying, you know, as God is my witness, I'll never be hungry again. And she wasn't. So we too can be Scarlett O'Hara. with a happier ending.
Always excited.
So, tonglen begins on the cushion. It doesn't end on the cushion, but it begins on the cushion. And the first part is taking refuge, preliminaries, whatever your situation is. And then he says, rest in the natural mind. And some teachers will say, flash absolute bodhicitta. So you're starting with that panoramic, large view. It's very important to do that, because this is a heart practice, but it's not an emotionally jarring practice. We need to begin with a sense of the transparency and the dreamlike nature of our worlds, and begin with the flexibility and the power of our own mind. And we don't have to spend much time with that. A minute or so. Less than that. But it's very important that relative bodhicitta is based on absolute bodhicitta. That compassion, as Trawag Rinpoche said a few times at the outset, compassion is based upon that kind of larger view of emptiness. It's not just mitlide or feeling badly, but it has to do with the natural activity of our minds. So we're starting there. And then what happens? Well, different. Trawag Rinpoche is a little vague here. And that's okay. But sometimes people make a big deal about where they start. And we're going to start on the breath. I like, personally, to start by breathing out, by aspirating, as it were. Because this is a joyful practice. It is not a practice to make us miserable. It is a practice of joy. So I like to begin by exuding some kind of joyfulness, some kind of sanity, whatever I can muster. Sometimes not much, but whatever I have is good enough. Some people like to think about some situation or some sentient being that sort of strikes their heart. The traditional Tibetan teachings talk about contemplating the kindness of one's mother. Sometimes that's an easy thing for people to do. Sometimes that's not so easy. Or contemplate the goodness of your child. Or what's that? That could also be difficult, of course. You could begin with your love for your child, even though he or she is a complete pain in the ass. That works.
That works. That always works.
But the word compassion in Tibetan is ninje. Jay is like noble. Nin is heart. So it's noble heart. So it's everything the Dalai Lama ever talks about. It's the only thing he talks about is developing noble heart. So that's what we're doing here. So a situation, a person, something that touches you. And what do? You breathe in their suffering. You can do it. You don't have to do it on the lungs. You can do it sort of 360 degrees sense around if you want. I like to do that because it sort of decentralizes the whole thing. I wind up sometimes, or when I started doing Tonglen for the first time, I was like breathing too much. So, there's no point in that. It's like I was trying so hard. But you begin by breathing in because you're genuinely concerned or feel badly or you want to help. And Trawag Rinpoche says nicely, you're not inviting toxins. Don't worry about that. This practice is to transform you. It's not a magical practice. And he says, what happens is what you breathe in sort of dissolves, it disperses as it reaches your heart. Which I think is a lovely notion because then you breathe out whatever happiness, sanity, joyfulness you can give 360 degrees around if you wish. And that's what makes Tonglen a joyful practice. We are using our innate ability to fantasize. Usually we fantasize to make ourselves feel comfortable or to try to we pretend we're getting even with somebody we don't like, But here, we are sort of using our imagination to cast out joyfulness. We become Santa Claus. And everybody has, all the little boys and girls have their toys and their candy, and everybody's happy. So that's not a bad attitude to proceed with Tonglen, as opposed to what people often do, and don't do this, which is they get very rigid and puritanical, and they make such a big deal about pain and suffering, and it becomes one more self-absorption. That is really very much about taking the kindness, gentleness, compassion, the love that you have, and just open it a little further. So you're not going to do more than you can do, which means immediately we find our limits. It's really clear what our limits are. We can do Tonglen with the neighborhood, like there's a neighborhood like cat that's a stray cat that's kind of scrawny and pathetic. That's easy. But what if it comes to mind our boss? And maybe our boss is having a hard time and we feel badly for our boss, and maybe the boss just chewed us out and we feel kind of pissed off. And we try to do Tonglen for our boss, we realize that we're sort of enjoying this guy's misery. Well, what are you going to do about that understanding? You're going to beat yourself up? No. You're going to say, okay, my love has limits. I'm okay with the stray cat in the neighborhood. I'm not so okay with my boss today. It's very humbling and very helpful. Because what we're also doing with Tonglen, we're not just taking in the suffering, we can take in the causes of suffering. What are the causes of suffering?
Other people.
I'm sorry, Lisa?
Other people.
Other people! No.
Bring out all the wrong answers.
It certainly seems that way to much of our experience.
Well, if you had the right answer.
What did you say, Muffy?
I said confusion.
Confusion? Oh, what does that mean? What are we confused about?
You don't understand what your boss is going through.
You don't understand what your boss is going through, and you're emotionally weak and vulnerable, and everything you take personally, right. And you spend a lot of time feeling just crappy about yourself.
Your boss is out to get you.
Your boss is out to get you. You get angry. You want to retaliate. So you can take in those causes of suffering. You identify that in yourself. But you may also realize that other people do the same damn thing. That's why they cause us so many problems. And so our recognition of our self-centeredness and our confusion and our stupidity and our missing the mark actually becomes fuel in this practice. Because we can take in that misery and send out the opposite, which is that openness and gentleness and spaciousness that we also have. So we use our defects as fuel. We use ego, our ego, as fuel for the path, for this training.
I had a question. So you said, send out joyfulness. Mm-hmm. I guess I often think of sending sort of love or sort of a kind act, which is maybe different. Or maybe it's not.
I don't know. Maybe it's not. Maybe it's not. I think this is our desire that others be happy.
I think I get stuck on, I wish they'd be less miserable, at least. I don't aspire high enough.
Okay. I hate to sound like an advertising campaign, but inspire higher. And Trotwig Rinpoche says that, you know, let's not worry, and it can go into our Tonglen. Let's worry less about reducing the negativity, but let's enhance the positive. We want people to be happy. We don't want to put conditions on that. They'll be happy as long, you know, we usually think they'll be happy as long as they continue to like me. But they can be just happy for no other reason than that you want them to be.
I'd just like to suggest that there's so many different ways of approaching this.
Yeah.
It's best for us not to get stuck in, as you were saying, that this is the view, and this is the view, and this is the only view. That actually, there's so many ways that we'll enter this through different periods of our own experience. Mm. So it's a big buffet of possibilities.
Yes,
of
yes.
Working with this.
And it also is like our kids. They grow us. And so this practice grows us. And we come to clearer, better understanding over time, and we'll try different things. It's a very personal journey. And so the payoff of the practice is that it's giving us a little respite in our habitual thing of taking pleasure for myself and keeping displeasure at a distance. Because we do that instinctively. We're sentient beings. We're biological creatures. We like comfort. We like happiness. We don't like inconvenience. And for a little while, we're reversing that. And again, we will find our limits really easily. And that's okay, because that's where we're starting from.
There's another point, too, that I contemplate, which is the benefit of going through difficult situations.
Mm.
So that whole aspect of even drawing in the difficulty or the heaviness or the pain or the whatever, it could be for yourself going through something, but seeing the benefit of these situations to work with our mind and to liberate ourselves.
Mm-hmm.
So there's kind of a natural kind of flip, you could say, in this practice, that what seems really awful turns into an opportunity for transformation. And we're not running away from difficult situations. We're not trying to create them, but when things happen, that's the courage part,
yeah.
I think.
We start with acknowledging it.
You acknowledge it, yeah. And
yeah.
You can acknowledge it and use that as a transformative experience to actually see through the transform that difficulty into wisdom, into equanimity towards whatever's happening.
And it also flies in the face of our modern society's emphasis on comfort.
Yeah, oh, for sure.
And how we don't like to make to feel uncomfortable in some ways. And we can push the envelope a little bit more on that, most of us. You know, bring in a little more awkwardness, a little more discomfort, not a lot, because we have limits. We have to respect our limits. We need to push against them a little bit. And again, that's a very personal journey that we all have. But what it does is it increases our confidence and our sense of our own capacity for wisdom, but also for creative action.
It makes me think of elastic. And, you know, you're pushing out the boundaries that way, rather than shrinking into yourself. And
yes.
The more we tighten our boundaries and shrink, the less freedom we have, because we can't move anymore when we're wrapped up.
Right, we're all wrapped up. We become mummies.
I had my father-in-law was dying of lung cancer and having terrible breathing issues, and I have asthma anyway, and I was trying to do Tantra for him, and it was so difficult for me.
Oh yeah.
To sort of, and of course my imagination, I was right there, you know. But my resistance was so strong, and my sense of tightness got tighter and tighter and tighter, until I could actually understand that it wasn't a matter of that I'm taking this, it's mine now.
It
was being transformed somehow. This, through my tightness, there was a hope that his tightness was being transformed, but it was very visceral and excruciating.
Yeah.
And was a path.
Yeah.
So
yes.
I think, you know, when you say you want, basically you want people to experience love or to feel warmth, or it isn't just sort of a Hallmark card. It's actually, as you were saying, it's through the path.
No, this is love full round.
Yeah.
This is not love because, you know, I like the cute part of you, or it's really nice hanging out with you. This is the whole thing. It's kind of like being married to the human race and to all sentient beings.
Yes, which is
you have to
so
deal with
easy.
Them 24/7. So, now, we take this on the road, or into our lives, or off the cushion and into the kitchen where our partner has left a lot of dishes in the sink and we have to go to work and we're kind of...
My husband goes to your house and does that there too.
You don't understand. I have this compulsion about cleaning the kitchen before I go to bed at night because I hate waking up to a dirty kitchen. It just drives me nuts. Okay.
You can hire Michael.
Take my husband, please.
So, take my husband, please.
He'll give lessons. He's good at it.
Yeah, but who are the gremlins who get up and dirty the dishes in the night?
I know. People
that
wash them at night.
So this is where the quote, post-meditation slogans come in handy. And the first one being three objects, three poisons, three virtuous seeds. And that brings us back to absolute bodhicitta. Obviously, the three objects are people we like, maybe too much, people we dislike, maybe way too much, people we don't really care about. And obviously, the three poisons are not love, but more like a gooey attachment. We seem to do that instinctively. Aggression, aversion, people we don't like. Or just sort of spacing out and not noticing the people we don't notice. And so what do we do about that? Because we all do that. We instinctively, like, you know, size people up. And we also know, however, that things change. That somebody can't stand in the month of October is somebody you can stand in the month of December. Or we know what it's like when somebody who we have a resentment about does something very kind for us. It's like we just melt. So we begin to see the situations in our life as much softer and more fluid. So we don't have to be on our guard. Nor do we trust that things will stay the same way forever. That this person's in my corner and this person's not in my corner. Because that switches all the time. And all of us have gone through any number of people in our lifetimes who we've known, who we've loved, who we can't stand, and they sort of cycle around. And we also have to appreciate, how is it that we like some people and dislike others? The Buddhists have a very cute way of answering everything like that. Causes and conditions. It doesn't happen spontaneously. It happens because something made it happen. It's part of our dreamlike world of interdependent origination. That things are sort of moving around each other, influence each other all the time, and we make such a big deal about what's happening in this moment, and we forget that this moment is only part of a longer stream. So that enables us to develop equanimity. If you think that compassion in a Buddhist sense is not feeling crappy about something or someone, but its result is it comes from equanimity. You care about everybody kind of equally. Even the people you're married to, you realize that you're just married to them. It could have been somebody else. Yeah, Buddhism doesn't do a whole lot with soulmates, by the way. But it also gives us the chance to, or it gives us the looseness and the openness to start to do tonglen on the spot. So on the spot, we can take in, we're in a work situation, everyone is just miserable and they're yelling at each other and they're shifting around blame, and you can just take that, you can, may all of their aggression and misery come to me, and may they have joyfulness and sanity and happiness on the spot. It's not going to make them joyful, happy, and sane. You can't, like, it's not a magical practice. We're transforming us. We're also seeing where we're pissed off, and we can't do that. And that's important. So it becomes sort of a post-meditation practice to notice what's happening around you, take that in mentally, let that dissolve, bring out benevolence, bring out love, bring out a desire, as Elise said, a desire that people not suffer so. So the other two slogans are kind of related to that. Train in slogans in all activities. And it's actually interesting because you sort of come up with your own slogans. Everyone quotes Jhampa Kontrol, who says, you know, here's a good one. Drawing a blank. Gain and happiness to others, loss and misery to myself. That's a way to reverse our normal concepts on the spot. Or you can use any of the Lojong slogans that you particularly feel are helpful, may help you look at the world differently. A personal favorite, again from Shanti Deva, is the fact that, you know, we have three kinds of relationships with people. We envy those we think have it better than us. We're arrogant with those who think we have it worse than us. And we're competitive with equals. And it's sort of a dark vision, no? But it's really helpful because it allows me to understand not only my own habitual patterns, but those of others. And it allows me to take in the misery of pride, competitiveness, and envy, and send out equanimity, send out more of a quality of joy. So train slogans in all your activities. And again, it's a personal journey. And, you know, you'll find out from either reading books like this or from your own experience sort of what does the job to you, for you. Now, I'll give you one hint. If it works, it feels weird. Because we have the situation where, and I'm sure it's not just me, I've come to realize that everything I experience, everybody else experiences too. It's very comforting. You know how you have this thing in your mind, I should be doing so and so, and you realize you're doing the exact opposite, and you can't stop doing the exact opposite, and you know, you just can't do anything else, and so it's very uncomfortable. And I used to hate that. And then I realized that this uncomfortableness is actually a sign that I'm making progress. I'm not just doing the habitual thing stupidly. I know better.
But you're still doing it.
But I'm still doing it.
That's the pain of it all.
It is. Painful.
It's terrible.
It's Yeah, it can be
can
terrible.
Can you do Tong Lan for that for us,
maybe
please? Thank
time.
You.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. If you desire to do Tong Lan for that, you realize that other people go through that too. So right. That can ripen yeah. on you.
Right.
And you can give out clarity. But it's also a sign that it's a sign of progress. You know, it's kind of like you know, strengthening a muscle through repetitions, and it's sort of hard and it's painful. And you realize you're getting stronger. So you let those situations come and you work with them and you feel crappy and you feel humiliated and you don't know.
Is it a sign of progress that you're aware? I mean,
it's a sign.
You didn't say joy, you said progress.
The progress, Michael?
That's the point.
The awareness. It's
awareness is the most precious element we have in our lives. And, you know, so it can be, it doesn't mean because it feels good, it can be very painful.
Okay.
But yeah. It's actually coming into the reality of things and actually seeing things as they are.
There's no place in Buddhism for the line that ignorance is bliss. Ignorance is misery. Awareness is bliss.
Well,
but also,
awareness, just to go further, awareness doesn't care what it sees.
Right.
Exactly.
And if we really begin to understand and appreciate awareness, we realize it's not something that is sitting here with a gavel and sending anything off to, you know, eternal torment. It's basically just seeing. It's just this seeing that's so fundamental to our experience. And the seeing doesn't have a seer. There's no one seeing, but it's just seeing itself. And so that's the point. And so, yes, you know, there's these byproducts of pleasure and pain that come along with it. Like, oh, my God, you know.
But also, I'm sorry. What's your first name? I'm sorry.
Kathleen.
But also what you're doing is these are like stress, spiritual stress tests.
There you go.
We like those
she
too.
She does not believe you. I usually fail those too.
They need to make them less stressful.
She is not buying one drop of it.
I get it.
Move
on. I'll remember that.
I'm having trouble with it because you said, but once it, we take in the awful stuff, once it hits our heart, it dissolves. But it doesn't sound like it because this part of the conversation sounds like it's not supposed to dissolve. We're supposed to feel pretty rotten.
No, we don't. And, no, we're not supposed to. It just happens.
I was struck with, you know, Erica, when you said, I mean, you actually had trouble breathing. I'm like, yeah. Holy God, is this really?
You know, but it was like, but it went away. I mean, it was sort of like, oh, maybe it was like an oh part of it.
But yeah. It did go away because it sounds like.
Well,
no, Emily had been telling me this. You don't take in the shit and hold it.
No. It's transformed fundamentally.
Yeah, that transformation stuff. You don't
fundamentally.
There we go.
The reason why we have the preliminaries, the reason why we have this flashing.
Michael's making sense here.
Okay.
Absolutely.
Before
we start this,
yes.
We want to really open up to absolute bodhicitta. We want to just completely, even if it's just momentary, we have this. And that gives us the spaciousness to work with this so that we're not taking this on as some solid thing and going, oh my God, now I'm, you know, worse off than I started. It's like, it's actually like phantasmal when we take on other people's confusions.
So like what?
Phantasmal. Yeah, it's not real. Yeah. I mean, the difficulty is that people's pain is that they believe it's real. I mean, we're not talking now, I'm differentiating between something like physical pain and psychological
pain.
Sure. When we're talking about people's confusion, we're not talking about because they have a pain in their leg because they broke it or something. That's not what we're talking about. We're talking about working with the confusion of the world. We're talking about working with the pain of other beings.
The world.
And we're wishing them goodness or happiness because we don't know what that... We don't have the recipe for them to do that, as Joseph is saying. It's like they're going to find their own way. We want them to find their own way. We want to encourage them to find their own way. So it's more like a learning process of how we can actually extend ourselves to others and... Mm-hmm. Take in an understanding of what it means to be them without, you know, trying to manipulate or anything, and allow ourselves to just be there with that. So in that sense, compassion is just being with or allowing ourselves to really be present to that.
And the final slogan is a sequence of exchange begins with ourselves.
Mm-hmm.
Which is a sort of a proactive. We're not waiting around for opportunities to appreciate sanity and experience confusion. It's already there.
I've got plenty.
We can just tune in to whatever is happening now, but we start with ourselves. So we can, at any time, take in the attitude of desiring happiness, desiring people not be unhappy, taking in, giving out, in sort of a way of life. And you find that you do that, you start to do that spontaneously. It just happens. You feel, you find that you're more thin-skinned in the positive way. Your armor doesn't work as well. And you're more open, you're more touched by circumstances. But it's not, but it feels like a strength. It doesn't feel like a vulnerability.
Hmm.
And so eventually, the real payoff is you discover that all of this stuff that you have that you call ego doesn't exist. That there's no such thing as ego. And then you can actually be helpful to other people.
Just So in number 10 here, begin the sequence of sending a tape of yourself. We're actually like sending out the love to ourselves.
Mm-hmm. We could do that. Sure.
Well, or, yeah. I mean, I'm
especially
to be allowed to be kind to ourselves.
Yes, we are. We are. It is a. It is mandatory. Yes. You must be kind to yourself.
Yeah.
Yes.
What it sounds like. But,
yeah.
Okay. Yes.
Yeah.
Absolutely. And you see, and this is just basic Hinayana Buddhism. You see yourself doing the same old crap and you relax with that a little bit. And sometimes you have to confront yourself. We can talk about reproach in a different time. But most of the time we have to sort of, you know, loosen some of the tightness we have. Okay, I don't have much else to say. No, I have a lot more to say, but I'm not going to say it. Arrogant.
No, I'm just saying.
Oh, yes, 9:04, so I'd run over a little bit by 1 minute because we started at 8:03. I'm sorry, Emily. We'll figure out what minute to cut out of my presentation.
You're doing fine.
So what's on tap for next
week? So next week's Thanksgiving. So eat well, have fun, and show a lot of compassion to all your relatives. Be nice. Don't throw mashed potatoes at them.
Or at yourself.
The following week will be a guided meditation on Tonglen. Yeah. And I will lead that. And then we continue on with the slogans. If you look online, Sandra has posted all the way to the end of this module. To the 21st of December. So you can look and see what we're going to cover. Yes.
I might have the thing about, but I might actually do a meditation Thanksgiving morning.
Oh,
wonderful.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. People can escape from their claustrophobic relatives.
There
you go.
Okay, so you'll send, that's another reason to get on the Google group, because you'll find out what's going to be presented here. So maybe Thursday morning.
And I'll be back here on the 14th to talk about confusion.
Very good.
So never be here or be square.